Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the Philippines' willingness to go forward with the prospective Russian submarine deal despite heavy American pressure. President Duterte rebuffed the earlier criticism of his plans that U.S. Assistant Defense Secretary for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs, Randall Shriver, warned wouldn't be a helpful thing to do in our alliance by rhetorically asking, "Who are you to warn us?" which was followed up by the Russian embassy in the Philippines suggesting that Shriver's statement may point to an acute attack of colonial syndrome. It was recently disclosed that Russia has already trained some of Duterte's bodyguards and plans to do the same with some of the country's naval personnel too, which would correspond to the possibility of Moscow selling Manila some of its state-of-the-art submarines that it's already provided to nearby Vietnam. The U.S. understands that its previous monopoly over its former colony's military procurement needs is rapidly drawing to a close, and that the purchase of big-ticket items such as submarines would lead to an extended relationship with Russia that would augur well for multipolarity, which is entirely against America's interest, especially as it tries to contain China in the South China Sea. About that, some might wonder why Russia would sell submarines to the Philippines if these can only realistically be used against China one day, in spite of Beijing being Moscow's closest partner. But a closer look at the nuances of military diplomacy reveals the strategy behind this move. Russia's post-Cold War arms sales have interestingly been focused on maintaining the balance of power between different pairs of rivaling states, be they Armenia and Azerbaijan, India and China, or China and Vietnam, with the most recent opportunities being with Turkey and Syria, Saudi Arabia and Iran, Pakistan and India, and possibly also the Philippines and China. The guiding concept is for Russia to retain the strategic state of affairs between each of these rivaling pairs in order to prevent the U.S. from decisively shifting the balance one way or another in favor of its preferred partner, and therefore encouraging a military conflict or some degree of brinksmanship that it could later exploit. Russia's prospective submarine deal to the Philippines would sideline the U.S. Navy, and therefore lay the basis for making Moscow, and not Washington, Manila's long-term military partner in this regard. The resultant elevation of Russia's regional status in the South China Sea, when taken together with its already solid military and energy partnerships with Vietnam, could conceivably enable Moscow to exert restraining influence on Hanoi and Manila in order to constructively contribute to a peaceful settlement of their maritime delineation issues with Beijing. It's an admittedly ambitious strategy at this point, but it's nevertheless a step in the right direction of gradually diminishing the U.S.'s regional influence, and is therefore more helpful than harmful to China's interests. The next one up is China's alleged weaponization of tourism to punish the Pacific island country of Palau for its continued political relations with Taiwan. Reuters published a report last weekend about the effects of China's decision last year to brand the nation an illegal destination because of its lack of diplomatic relations with it, which has had a domino effect of not only destroying the tourism industry that its nationals previously dominated, but also all the other businesses associated with it. The outlet quoted a hotel owner who said that some people believe that the dollars were allowed to flow in and now they're pulling it back to try and get Palau to establish ties diplomatically, a strategy that he described as amounting to China weaponizing tourism. On the surface, this certainly seems to be the case, and it's well known that China is using all the necessary means at its disposal to silently sway Taiwan's remaining 17 international allies to its side. Looking deeper, however, there are good reasons for China to take the action that it did against Palau, because it's unable to assist its citizens, both physically and in terms of their economic rights, if something ever happened, without having a diplomatic presence there that can only occur if the island recognized Beijing as a legitimate government of China. The slightly more than 20,000 Palauans should have known that this would happen sooner or later and shouldn't have allowed themselves to grow so dependent on Chinese money. But they're not alone in having had something of the sort happen to them, nor is China the only country that has ever utilized this strategy. In fact, the U.S. is presently doing this on a global scale, by weaponizing access to its markets through primary and secondary sanctions after making most of the world dependent on them over the past two decades. Both the EU and India, for example, are in differing states of complex, albeit somewhat lopsided, economic interdependency with the US and require access to its markets for continued growth, which is why both of them have quietly backtracked on their support of Iran after Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal a few months ago and threatened everyone else with secondary sanctions if they continue doing business with it following the reimposition of primary sanctions. This global power play is undoubtedly much more consequential than China turning the screws on a tiny country to abandon Taiwan, though the mainstream media deliberately does everything it can do to distract from it. Third on our countdown, we have Nepal's anti-conversion law coming into effect. The new restrictions were originally promulgated late last year and outlaw proselytization practices that are understood as implicitly targeting the historically Hindu country's rapidly growing community of Christian evangelicals, despite ostensibly being aimed at protecting the feelings of religious believers. A key component of the legislation decrees that no one should convert a person from one religion to another religion or profess their own religion and belief with similar intention by using or not using any means of attraction and by disturbing the religion or belief of any ethnic groups or community that's been practiced since ancient times. In other words, it's meant to preserve Hinduism in the face of aggressive Christian campaigning that has seen the country's believers in Christ triple over the past decade, as religious NGOs flooded into Nepal and allegedly took advantage of its socio-economically vulnerable population to spread the gospel. The foreign-backed spread of Christianity has always been a sensitive issue in some Asian countries because of the legacy of imperialism and reliance on religious figures as fifth columnists, especially because of the potential that they have for disrupting the status quo in traditional societies and exploiting Christian tenets for revolutionary purposes. What's interesting about all of this is that Nepal's present government isn't comprised of Hindu traditionalists, but of secular communists. Though they understand the long-term challenge that foreign-backed religious minority organizations can pose to national stability. The claims that this amounts to religious favoritism and going back to a Hindu kingdom are inaccurate because the ruling Chinese-friendly authorities aren't by any stretch of the imagination biased towards India and its interests, but are trying to delicately balance relations between their two great power neighbors. This law should therefore be understood as being driven by national security considerations instead of anything else. Nevertheless, because it does indeed aim to counter the growing influence of foreign Christian NGOs in the country, it's probably going to lead to more of an intensified info war against the authorities that's actually fueled by the government's unprecedented Silk Road and military partnerships with China, not its supposed support of potentially Indian-influenced Hindus. The perception management gimmick is that a genuinely Chinese-friendly government is being attacked for supposedly being pro-Hindu in order to destabilize it and lead to political concessions that are actually in India's interest, with Christians just being used as bait to attract as much international attention and possibly condemnation as possible. Our runner-up is the U.S. declaring that it'll remain in Iraq for as long as needed. This policy pronouncement was made by Colonel Sean Ryan, the spokesman for Combined Joint Task Force Operation Inherent Resolve, who justified it on the basis of ensuring Daesh's defeat and training the Iraqi military. National Security Advisor John Bolton and other U.S. officials have previously said that their country's military presence in neighboring Syria was being prolonged in order to partially contain Iran, so it's likely that this is also the real intent when it comes to Iraq too. The U.S. is aware of Grey Cardinal Muqtada al-Sadr's predisposition to balancing between Iran and Saudi Arabia, so this must also be included in any analysis of its approach towards the country, and probably explains its risky sanctions strategy too. Iraq has intimate socioeconomic and energy links with Iran that are impossible to sever without dealing disastrous damage to the country, though the U.S. is nevertheless trying to pressure it into complying with its sanctions against the Islamic Republic under threat of coming under so-called secondary sanctions itself. Prime Minister al-Abadi has given mixed signals about his willingness to go along with this scheme, but Iraq will probably be forced to downgrade some of its ties with its neighbor, even if it's not possible to cut them all off completely. This will destabilize the situation in the parts of the country that are most closely tied to Iran, which is Iraq's second largest non-energy trading partner behind Turkey. Not only could this contribute to the growing gap between the pro-American and Turkish-tied Kurds in the north and some of the more skeptical Iranian-aligned Arabs in the south that could be exploited by the lingering U.S. military presence in the country, but it could also create space for Saudi Arabia to propose a GCC bailout package as part of its long-term bid to displace Iran's economic position in Iraq. Al-Sadr and al-Abadi would likely go along with this as the only pragmatic option available to them, despite the obviousness of this being a joint American-Saudi reverse-engineered hybrid war solution to the manufactured socioeconomic crisis that the U.S. is creating. At our top spot, we've got the regional politicization of the Venezuelan migrant crisis and its military strategic exploitation by the U.S. Long simmering tensions finally exploded in a Brazilian border town after four Venezuelans robbed, beat, and stabbed a restaurant owner before the locals violently drove hundreds of them back to their country, which dangerously led to some of these coercively repatriated migrants carrying out reprisal attacks against some Brazilians in Venezuela. Brasilia responded by deploying troops to the border town, and Venezuela demanded that its southern neighbor ensure the security of its citizens in the country, but the flood of an estimated 2.3 million Venezuelan migrants throughout the region over the past couple of years has overwhelmed local communities and contributed to a destabilizing weapons of mass migration dynamic. To explain, Ivy League researcher Kelly M. Greenhill's breakthrough 2010 research describes the inevitably disruptive effect that different categories of large-scale population flows can have and how this can be exploited for political purposes. The estimated 50,000 Venezuelan migrants that crossed into Brazil's Roraima border state where the latest clashes took place are equivalent to nearly 10% of its total population, so it was only a matter of time before tensions with the locals spilled over and created a political crisis. Something similar is also happening elsewhere in South America, albeit not yet to as dramatic of a degree as in northern Brazil, but the political ripples are nevertheless apparent. Ecuador just mandated that the citizens of its nominal Bolivarian ally could only enter the country with their passports instead of their usual identity cards that most of them have been using for the years now, per an agreement between both countries, which was soon thereafter followed up by Peru, announcing the same restriction that is intended to curtail the flow of Venezuelan migrants into both Andean countries, who oftentimes lack this international document. It's predicted that this could lead to thousands of Venezuelan migrants being stuck in Colombia, which is why the U.S. announced it'll dispatch a hospital ship to NATO's newly designated and first-ever Latin American global partner following Mattis's recent visit to the country. This is a disturbing sign of mission creep that followed deliberately leaked reports last month about Trump's purported willingness to invade Venezuela last year, which seem in hindsight to be part of a pronounced psychological pressure campaign on the beleaguered country's leadership that preceded the failed U.S.-linked drone assassination attempt against Maduro 4 weeks later. Although the Venezuelan-Brazilian clashes in northern Roraima state last weekend were an organic outcome of the weapons of mass migration dynamic that the U.S. created through its hybrid war on Venezuela, the tacit regional coordination between Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia wasn't, with this actually being part of the U.S.'s pre-planned politicization of the humanitarian crisis. It was purely coincidental that the clashes happened when they did, but they provided a convenient justification for clamping down on the freedom of regional movement that Venezuelan migrants previously enjoyed, and consequently provoking the manufactured pretext for the U.S. to dispatch its hospital ship to Colombia, where many of them are now stranded in desperate conditions. It's conceivable that a more robust military deployment to the country could be forthcoming and committed to under the disguise of a humanitarian intervention. The U.S.'s goal might not want to invade Venezuela like recent reports alleged, but to use the migrant crisis that it's partially responsible for as the opportunity to make Colombia the post-pink-tide regional leader. Colombia's comparatively larger population and economy, as well as its geostrategic bio-oceanic position, make it the U.S.'s ideal lead-from-behind partner, and its growing proxy influence over Ecuador, Peru, and part of the anti-government Venezuelan population is leading to the de facto creation of a so-called Gran Colombia that the U.S. wants to use for reorganizing South America. Its newly elected right-wing leader declared that it will withdraw from the UNASUR Continental Integrational Bloc, which follows Ecuador threatening to seize its headquarters in the country last month. So it wouldn't be surprising if Colombia encourages its Ecuadorian, Peruvian, and possibly even Brazilian neighbors to do the same, and effectively destroy UNASUR, thus reversing one of the greatest accomplishments of the Pink Tide era. Alright folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.